Let us refresh ourselves on what are the 37 requisites of enlightenment. We have a new group, and the old group had it down cold, but we're starting again. So the first set is the Noble Eightfold Path. I'm sure you've had talks on that. Seven factors of enlightenment on the next set. Five faculties, five powers, four foundations of mindfulness, four right efforts, and the four bases of success, or the roads to psychic strength. So these are the 37, and these overlap. So we actually, in the end, I think we have actually 14 different factors. So you see there's quite a bit of recurrence of some of them. They overlap. And it's interesting. It's something that you can contemplate yourself. It might be a rewarding thing to just think about, like, why does the Buddha set it up this way? Each of these, like the systems, so the Eightfold Path occurs very early in his teachings. And it's obviously a nice overview, fairly accessible for understanding. So, of course, the first sermon he gives is this Dhammacakka Sutta, this basically on the Four Noble Truths. And one of the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path, the fourth truth. So what he is a very organized, lucid, systematic teacher. He's not just a brilliant person. There's all kinds of brilliant people out there that can't really organize material and transmit it to an audience at different levels. So that's the impressive part of the Buddha, is that he has this very refined experience that he talks about as enlightenment or awakening, a liberation from, and then he defines what it is. So that's another level of clarity, because there are mystics out there that have all kinds of, they say they've had this experience and it changed them. But how it changed them is less clear. Some of them remain silent, don't want to communicate it. But the Buddha had this breakthrough experience and then reflected on it, so to communicate it to others, and that's an element of compassion as well, but organized thinking. And so he sets it down as that the primary problem for him was the resolution of suffering. What is there anything you can do as a human to reduce the experience of suffering, especially in the psychological dimension? Now, his primary aim is in the psychological dimension. He's not a health food guru. He's not a doctor in the sense of fixing your body. He is actually encourages people to take care of their health and go see a doctor if they need to and so forth. But he never set out with the idea that you could cure everything. And there are various religious teachings that think you can, that all bodily illnesses are curable or through prayer or something like that. The Buddha did not think so. But he thought that the psychological, emotional condition of humans could be drastically improved if they had certain views that they could maintain. And so this is his quest, was to see if he could see a way through this situation. But he's also got a larger context, which we can't just talk about in this life. Buddhism is not merely a psychotherapy for this life. It's on the grand scheme of things, lifetimes of possibilities, and the almost incalculable places that you could find yourself in the migration of consciousness through various levels of being. So from a Buddhist point of view, you are not a fixed identity. You're fluid, and you can transpose radically into different levels of consciousness and being through rebirth processes, and of course in this very life. You see transformations of people in this very life. Their character is changed. They come across a new way of thinking and see life differently, and they're radically changed. You can see bodily transformations as well in this life. See people losing weight or gaining weight or developing skills and so forth. Everything is up for change from a Buddhist point of view. But the ultimate level, it's not satisfactory. None of the conceivable types of being that we may come up with are ultimately satisfactory, including the idea of heaven. So this is somewhat jarring for the Christian West, or wherever Christianity is, it's in the East as well. And there are a number, most religions have some sort of idea of a heaven, a place of where you are safe, you know, eternally safe. The Buddha did not hold that. He had very detailed ideas of heaven, very elaborate descriptions of these kind of realms outside of the human realm. In fact, when you think of heaven and Christianity, it's actually very poorly sketched out. There's hardly any specific descriptions of what they meant by heaven. 500 years before, there's an absolute crystalline and elaborate detailed descriptions of not just heaven, but there are all kinds of levels and layers of heaven and the human realm, of course. The human realm is vast. The Buddha said that you see these animals, the bodies of animals, think of a snake, a fish, a cow, an eagle, all of the varieties, the sizes of the animal bodies and the variations of animals all the way from no legs to thousands of legs, centipedes and so forth, millipedes, and then those that walk around on two legs and so forth. And the range of consciousness in humans is greater than the differences in all of the bodies of animals. So the spectrum of difference in human ways of seeing things and understanding things and the levels of consciousness within just in human realm is greater than the variety of bodily differences in animals. A tremendous description of the different, it's more or less psychology of human consciousness. So he describes all kinds of them. And of course he goes into great detail about temperaments, dominant of greed temperaments, anger temperaments, delusional temperaments, faith temperaments, intelligent temperaments, mixtures of all of these. They come in various mixtures. Nobody is sort of absolutely one or the other. For the ordinary person, three things are at work in some proportion, and you can see it, you know, in your own experience with people. Some are dominantly greedy, but not particularly angry, and others are quite angry, but fairly generous, and some are just confused and dull, and some are quite strongly all three, very greedy, very angry, and quite dull and confused. all kinds of elaborations on this. So this is what he is looking at. And of course, they have great observations of the animal realm as well. You see observations of animal attitude and emotions and behavior that you don't see in the West until sometime in the 19th century. Just notice in your, probably in your own lifetimes, how the perception of animals have changed. I know in Vancouver, what we have is called killer whales, you know. In the 60s, they were kind of considered like a pack of terrible wolves or something in the ocean. And then somebody managed to bring back a wounded orca to the Vancouver aquarium. And it was the first sort of captured orca. And they began to study it and realized how intelligent it was. And it had emotions and it was depressed and it was happy sometimes. And a radical, absolute transformation. Again, this was the dolphins and whales. And this is because of the whole, you know, inherited view of what animals are. Buddhists are coming at from a very different attitude. In fact, feeling that in case that animals have the possibility of evolving into humans. Of course, we know that from evolutionary theory as well. And humans can devolve into animal states as well. So it's all kinds of possibilities in this spectrum of consciousness. Very, very detailed. And the Buddha is trying to solve the issue. So it's not just getting into one type of realm of consciousness, because that flexibility and impermanence and instability of conditions persists in all of these realms. So you're not stabilized in a particular realm. Being itself is an issue. So that's what he's trying to solve with his attempt to find a solution to the inherent suffering of different possible experiences in life, of different beings as well. So he does come up with this, and then he has to transmit ideas. And the ideas, of course, it's not all absolute. So the type of solutions that individuals are seeking and gaining from the practice of Buddhism or practice of Dhamma are different. Some people are just trying to improve the quality of their life a little bit. They're really not preoccupied with the attainment of nirvana. Even in Asian countries and Buddhist countries, that's not what's on people's minds mostly. They're trying to improve the quality of their present lives and perhaps the future lives. But it's a very high aspiration to be striving for nibbana. And they're usually leaving it to the monastics to endeavor there. And quite a few of the monastics are only temporarily attempting to improve the quality of their understanding and everything, but they're not really expecting to move towards enlightenment. But there is something for everyone, and it has great opportunity to improve everybody's quality of life if they listen. And he gives some very practical advice just about how to navigate ordinary life, how to go to work, what helps, how to deal with your family, relationships, how to improve the quality of your thinking processes, your emotional processes, material processes, all of these things. So he's organizing these kind of menus of practices, and some of them are more focused on the development of the inner life, the mind, and so forth, and others are focused on the overall larger description. So the Eightfold Path has this three aspects of what it is: sila, samadhi, panya, which is all kinds of instructions about behavior and just the basics of how to not make a mess of your life. Good advice about how to restrain certain type behaviors and how to speak in a social context as well, right? Speech and the attitudes that you can develop as well. So he talks about right intention. and right livelihood and so forth. And then in the upper part of the path, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And those, so that higher three, he takes those separately and then he puts them a little bit under a microscope and expands those, because those take a lot more practice. Most people's lives greatly benefit from a couple of things, and this is, you'll see this focus in Buddhist cultures in the East, is primarily the development of, first of all, respect for the Buddha as a wise teacher, respectful. There's a lot of resources there, so they develop this. There's Buddhist statues everywhere and temples and so forth, and the idea that this is a place, a resource. It's like a library. This is a place where you can find out a lot of things about the mysteries of life. Good advice here. So there's this kind of a development of certain kind of confidence or faith and reverence. And when that's there, now not everybody continues to inquire, but at least they have something to respect, you know. And then the possibility of community as well, so Sangha, and how that is supportive to a good way of life and very important to maintain. And then you have these specialists, there's the monks and nuns that are walking around, and that's helpful. It's a good mixture in society and the visual contact as well. The Buddha is quite good at marketing. He has monks, you can't keep food and cook for yourself, so you've got to go out and look for food every day, and that makes you present to the society around you as well. So there's a continuous awareness. The society around you is quite aware of it. You're not really cloistered. You're interacting. This is a teaching in itself, the presence of the monks and why we shave our heads and wear the robes and so forth. It's an instant brand recognition and the triggering in the mind. So people are up to all kinds of things. They're swimming in the problems of life and everything, but every now and then you see a visual signboard walking by, and it's literally the monk is kind of a sign, and it just jars on your, it catches your attention and makes you think, oh yeah, right, the big picture. You know, what is the meaning of this thing called life, and what happens when we die, and things like that. That triggers cosmic picture. So then, for those who want to go farther, this is why he encourages people to go to these community places, the temples and so forth, or invite monks to give talks, and to have sort of a special day on a full moon and new moon. Of course, that was their clock in those days. As with many of the older cultures, they were lunar calendars. It's something that everybody can be aware of. You may not have any other timepiece or calendar that you can do, but everybody can sort of see, it's a full moon, new moon. And then one should make a special effort to practice a little bit of, like, hear some Dhamma, a little more restraint of the frivolous things and entertainments and so forth, a reduction of that, focus on what's the meaning of this life again? What am I supposed to be doing? How can I improve my life? And if they can pick up a few ideas about practicing at home also, so you do see descriptions of lay people, of course, in the time of the Buddha attaining enlightenment and various stages of enlightenment, the first, the second, the third stage of enlightenment. And some are even attaining fourth stage and then entering the robes. They're not remaining in the household life after that. And some of them have deep experiences of samadhi as well, deep jhanic experiences. And there's conversations that they have in the village at the well. You say, what are you meditating? Yeah, I'm meditating. What are you doing? I do, mindfulness stuff. Well, which of the four foundations are you doing? I'm doing mindfulness of the body. Oh, me, I mostly mindfulness of feelings, yeah. Now, mindfulness of mind is my thing, you know, and then you head back, you've got your bucket of water, you head back to... So this kind of discussion is actually recorded, sort of village discussions on their practitioners. But they have 10 children, so you know, you can't just go off on 10-day retreats. We're fortunate at this time that we have the ability and the places to go for an extended period of time. But mostly in that time, the temples are very close. They're maybe a half a kilometer away, and you're able to go back and forth and get advice and so forth. But extended periods of in the monasteries, lay people are hard to get. But that didn't stop them from practicing and seeing the monks every day. And of course, if you go to even Thailand today, you'll see every single day in these villages, monks walking through the village. And the village temples are, of course, the bells are waking everybody up. So this is woven into all kinds of levels of life. And some of these teachings are more for the higher, more diligent, meditative part of the life. So the seven factors of awakening are a list of enlightenment factors. And those are to be cultivated. They're found implicitly. What they are is, so first of mindfulness at the top of the list, investigation of Dhamma, energy, joy, the emotion of joy, tranquility, joy lapsing or moving towards tranquility, finally into deep samadhi, concentration, the full jhanas, and then the seventh factor is equanimity, this perfect emotional balance, more or less like an accomplished philosopher looking at the world, not a modern philosopher, but more like a Greek philosopher with perfect equanimity and mastery of the emotions, and also deep stillness, which is only found in these deep concentration. So these are the seven factors. They are actually implicit in the Eightfold Path under right effort. And it's the third and the fourth right effort. So the first two under right effort in the Eightfold Path is the effort to prevent unwholesome mental states from arising and the effort to remove unwholesome mental states that have arisen. So that's the first two of the right efforts. Third and fourth are to infuse positive mental states that have not yet appeared, to create them, to plant them, and then the fourth is to increase and develop and deepen and sustain them. So the last two, the creation of them and the development of them, are a reference to the seven factors of enlightenment. That's what is supposed to be planted, developed, sustained, deepened, refined. So you see that it's in a kind of a general form in the Eightfold Path, and then these other menus are amplifications of this, the seven factors, amplifications. You'll also see some crossovers. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is samadhi, sama samadhi, right concentration or right jhanas. And you'll see the list of the four jhanas under there. So that's the sixth factor of the seven factors of enlightenment. But it's more blown up. The next set is the five faculties, which are another way of looking at things so that one balances. Each person is going to have personality tendencies. Some people are quite easily gain faith and confidence in things. Others are skeptics. They're suspicious of things. They question things. They have trouble committing to things. They're not aware of this, of the joy of trust and faith and so forth. So the five faculties, the first one is saddha, or confidence, or faith. And this is explicit in the teachings of the Buddha. Quite often you'll have, there was a period of time in the West, in history, I think it was an idea that it's more like Buddhism is kind of scientific, and it's just a confirmation of your own experience. But actually the Buddha is very explicit that faith or confidence, reasoned conviction is a very important element of the personality. It allows you to make steps towards something which you're not fully knowledgeable about, and yet you can trust it for a penny in order to go forward and try it. So this is what is shown in these five faculties. This is the first of the five faculties, and it also is the first of the five powers. And I'll talk a little bit about how they match each other. We come across energy again, is the second of the faculties. The third is mindfulness, which, of course, we see both of those in the Eightfold Path as well. And we see both of those in the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. So we have mindfulness as the first factor. It's the third factor in the five faculties. Energy refers to the right effort, and it's the second factor of the five faculties. Concentration is the fourth of the five faculties, and panya, or wisdom, is the fifth. So this is really a very important teaching, and very important to, I think, maybe the Western psychology as well. It's like we're raised in I think the educational system wants us to be very analytical. It wants us to critique ideas. It wants us to analyze things. It doesn't let us just blunder around as medieval peasants. It has a whole bunch of analysis and so forth. And so it doesn't dismiss that, but it says that this must be balanced with the capacity to actually go ahead, because if you're excessively analytical or skeptical, it's a very unsatisfactory condition. There's two problems, one in their extreme. One is to believe nothing, and the other one is to believe everything. Those are very easy things to do and very unsatisfactory situations to be in. Because if you believe everything, you may get things that are very harmful. And if you believe nothing, you have this unpleasant feeling of just endlessly and in an infinite numbers of questions which are unsatisfactory to the nature of human happiness and well-being. So somehow those things have to balance, and they have to support each other. Some ability to go ahead and walk into the unknown, but not just any unknown, but a reasoned conviction, and the faculty of wisdom, or intelligent consideration, helps you with this. It helps balance it. It helps question. It helps clarify. But you do need to make a move sometimes. You can't just sit there, because you will die before you can end the questions. So the third of this faculty is mindfulness, and this kind of arbitrates about the balance between these things. So you can see these are on the ends, and sometimes one is excessive, and the other one needs each other. The second and fourth of these faculties, energy and concentration, they need each other too, and mindfulness observes these two and says, Your energy is getting out of hand. That's too much energy. That is going towards agitation. You need to focus, calm down, clarify, and that's concentration. Or it says, concentration, you're stilling the mind, but you're actually going off to sleep as well. You don't have enough energy. You're going sinking. So you need to infuse it with more energy. So this is this little teaching card menu that you can fill in there. It's very handy for looking at your own personality and looking at what you need. And then if you succeed at this, you will have turned them into powers. So the five powers are identical to the five faculties. They are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. But now they are at a state where they are cannot be overcome by so their doubts. Your faith is strong. You've had experience. You're strongly convinced, and it's not prone to, in the middle of the night, doubts or various things which overturn it. Energy is strong. It doesn't turn into agitation. Mindfulness is strong. It keeps an eye on things. It is not prone to falling apart. Concentration is, you can attain concentration at will and sustain it, and it is not inclined to sloth or distraction. And wisdom is with you and clear. So the conclusions you've come to and your understanding and so forth are clear and sustainable. And now those five are now powers. So this is like a little structure in itself, especially side by side, looking at your own deficits, your strengths. Some people are, as we mentioned, the Buddha was talking about the range of consciousness is greater than the strange differences of bodies in animals. You can look at your own personality structure and see where you have some strengths and where you have some weaknesses, and that look, just putting that five faculties and five powers, you can learn about yourself. You can have an overlay about yourself. It's a way of coming to understand yourself in some ways. The next three sets are sets of four. Right effort, which of course is found in the Eightfold Path. And it's incredibly important. Let me just say that of the 37 requisites, 9 of them are some form of right effort or energy. And it's the one that occurs most. It's repeated and overlaps the most. Energy and effort, like, so you could say that Dhamma and Buddhism is a religion of effort. It is absolutely the center piece of the Dhamma is that this is a human endeavor, and it's you that does it. And this is he's so strong on this, because if you look around at the rest of the ancient world, how to navigate, how to deal with life had not much to do with personal effort. It was externalized. There were all kinds of spirits and devas and magic spells. It was a world of magical thinking, and there was not much advice about. You would go to somebody who would cast a spell or give you something, or a magic talisman, or you'd make a sacrifice of a goat. Or the Buddha is revolutionizing almost all of the endeavors of the ancient world, saying, "Hey, this is a human experience." Those things are ineffective. Those are rites and rituals, which is not how you undo your suffering. So this is why he keeps giving you so many variations and emphasis on efforts and the requirement of energy and effort. The next four are right mindfulness. And of course, you've all had mindfulness courses. Maybe some of you have been here. I think some of you have been here through. I've given lots of retreats. I don't know how many retreats you've been on, but I give whole retreats, sometimes 2 weeks, on mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness, just on the seven factors of enlightenment, just on right effort. So this four foundations of mindfulness, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, but this is, again, this is so you have right effort in the path, right full path, you have right effort, sixth factor. Right mindfulness, seventh factor. And so he is pulling that out and emphasizing this is incredibly, drastically important. The seventh factor, you have to understand it. And by the way, a lot of the courses that you hear out there, especially the lay teachings on mindfulness, really don't understand its function in the path. One of its functions is to lead you to the eighth factor, the path, not surprisingly. And the eighth factor cannot be attained unless five things have been overcome, the five hindrances. So it's not just awareness of the activities of the mind. Mindfulness is not a practice, just awareness of the activities of the mind. It is to purify the mind of the five hindrances, and that's an impediment to getting to the eighth factor, the right concentration. The last group of four is called the Iddhipadas, or the basis of power. And they happen to be very human as well, and will be familiar to all of you here. All of you have had to go to school. You've had to do degrees sometimes. You have to get work. You have to have strong motivation. You have to figure out how do I accomplish something? How do I accomplish my life in the world, in a relationship, in a family, in work, in the social structures. These are the Iddhipadas, the powers, psychic powers, are what humans need to do. They have to abandon somewhat magical ideas about how things go. In other words, it's not because of the alignment of the stars. It's not because of sacrifices to the deities. It's that you have chanda, you have strong aspiration and interest and determination, and that you have energy. Again, energy occurs again. You have to energetically undertake this. It takes a lot. Sometimes you got to go try to finish a degree and work at a pizza parlor at the same time. Just try to get through. It's amazing what people managed to do. And that the Buddha is saying, yeah, that's human effort, and that's where it happens, and that's how you get spiritual results. It is by your human efforts and your human motivations. And we get a factor, what's called citta, or just the knowledge of the mind, that more or less how the mind works, being interested in your inner life. How is my mind working? What am I thinking? How do I think? What, etc. That inquiry into that is the basis of development of power. And the fourth one is called vimansa, and it's just another way of saying wisdom. And it's a faculty which is not a synonym for intelligence. It's not similar to being smart. It's not smartness. It's wisdom is more or less knowing the priorities in life. What matters? Where do I direct my attention? What is my priority here? What do I spend my time thinking about in order to arrive at this goal? And what is that wisdom is the requirement of what is the worthy goal? And the goal, the Buddha says, there is one most worthy of all goals, and that is reduction or elimination of suffering. And that is not, if you do well on IQ tests, it does not indicate you're wise. Because all of the stuff that allows you to score highly on an IQ test, it only is wisdom if it's directed to some specific goal, because it might just be directed to physics or mathematics or music or all of these things, but they don't necessarily reduce suffering. They might, as a side effect, they might as a livelihood or something like that. It's fine, but if your intelligence and your determination and your aspiration and your insights are all geared to this? Why am I inflicting unnecessary suffering on myself? And what about others? Can I contribute to their well-being in some way? Can I offer some advice which might help them as well? So this is the point of the 37 requisites of enlightenment, and they all have their functions and paths and help you. Some people will be really helped by, say, investigating the five faculties. Some people will, the Eightfold Path will be how things are clarified for them. So you have a choice. And of course, you don't have to know all of this stuff inside out. It's just that it's a good opportunity to go on a retreat and get a little exposure to these basic menus and so forth. But you will have a very extensive sense of the entire Pali Canon, the 45 volumes, the thousands and thousands of pages. By just having this nice little overlay, you will be guaranteed access. So, by the way, this isn't something that I compounded, or even the commentaries selected a bunch out. This is actually a sutta by the Buddha saying, this is the essence of the whole Dhamma I teach, these 37 requisites of enlightenment. Then he just names them off. The Eightfold Path, seven factors, the five faculties, the five powers, the four efforts, the four foundations of mindfulness, and the four basis of power. And again, so for this group, I'm going to give you a phone number. Repeat after me, 875-5444. Buddha speaking. That's how you remember the 37 requisites of enlightenment. Okay, we'll leave it for tonight, and we will proceed through them in detail.